that, but David and Mac heard the crate being torn open. "No casket?" the doctor said. "Get him into the fridge." "In the bag or out?" Peter said. "In," she said. "I don't even want to think how much blood he's lost in there. I'm not starting till 10 per instructions, but let's get ready." Several minutes passed with minimal conversation, much of it related to their finding the plastic amalgam and her instructing her assistants how and where and when to have it ready. "You think this winch can handle a man his size?" "Never saw a portable one before," Peter said. "We'll make it work." David fast-forwarded until he heard conversation and stopped only when it seemed meaningful. Finally, he was at the 10 o'clock point and the cooler was opened again. Dr. Eikenberry switched on a recorder and spoke into a microphone David had seen hanging from the ceiling when he helped deliver her supplies. "This is Madeline Eikenberry, M.D. and forensic pathologist, here in the morgue at Global Community Palace in New Babylon, with assistants Peter Berger and Kirsten Skolten. They are bringing to the table the body of Nikolai Jetty Carpathia, age 36. We will remove the corpse from the body bag into which it was placed following his death approximately 14 hours ago in Jerusalem, cause to be determined." David and Mac heard the transfer of the bag from gurney to examining table. "I don't like the sound of that," Dr. Eikenberry muttered. "It feels as if he may have nearly bled out." "Yuck," Kirsten said. "Could you spell that for the transcriptionist, dear?" the doctor said. Then, "Oh no, oh my, ah! Keep it off the floor. Peter, make sure it drains through the table." "What a botch! Okay, transcriptionist, you know what to leave out. Pick up here." The body was not properly prepared for transfer or storage, and several liters of blood have collected in the bag. The body remains dressed in suit and tie and shoes, but a massive wound about the posterior head and neck, which will be examined once the deceased is disrobed, appears to be the exit area for the blood. It sounded to David as if Carpathia's clothes were being cut off. "No apparent anterior wounds," Dr. Eikenberry said as the sound of spraying water came through. "Let's turn him over." "Oh, be careful of that," she swore again and again. "Get his doctor in here now, and I mean now. What in the world is this? I was told none of this." The footsteps must have been Kirsten's running to the door to have someone look for the doctor, because Peter could be heard as clearly as the doctor. "I thought you were to look for a bullet entry wound." "So did I. Is someone trying to kill us?" More spraying, grumbling, and mumbling. Finally, the door opened again. Hurried footsteps. "Doctor," Eikenberry began, "why wasn't I told of this?" "Well, we... Turning over a man with this kind of a weapon still in him is 10 times more dangerous than a cop sticking his bare hands in a perp's pocket without checking for needles or blades first." "I'm sorry, You're sorry?" "You want to help pull this out?" "Ah, never mind. Just tell me if there's anything else I should have known." The doctor sounded thoroughly intimidated. "Well, to tell you the truth..." "Oh, please, at least do that. I think it's about time, don't you?" "Uh-huh, well, you know you're to look for bullet... damage, wounds, yes. What?" "The fact is, the EMTs are of the opinion, the same ones who prepared, or I should say left unprepared, a body like this..." "That wasn't their fault, ma'am. I understand the Supreme Commander was pushing everyone to get the body out of there." "Go on." "The EMTs believe you will find no bullet wounds." A pregnant silence. "Frankly, Doctor, I don't care what we find. I'll give you my expert opinion. And if there are also bullet holes, I'll include that. But can you answer me one thing? Why does everybody think there was a shooter, and why is that former employee pretty much being charged in the media? Because his prints were found on a weapon that didn't shoot Carpathia? I don't get it. As you said, ma'am, if you'll pardon me, it isn't your place to care about the cause of death, but only to assess it. Well, I'd say about an, 15 to 18 inch, what would you call this, doctor, a big knife or a small sword? A handled blade, certainly. Certainly. I'd hazard a guess that this, whatever it is, entering about 2 inches below the nape of the neck and exiting about half an inch through the crown of the skull, that certainly didn't enhance the victim's health, did it? No, ma'am. Doctor, do you really not know why I wasn't informed of this major, likely lethal wound? I know we didn't want to prejudice you. She laughed. Well, you certainly succeeded there. As for nearly slicing open my assistants and me, what do you say to that? I guess I thought you'd see the, sword. Doctor, the man was swimming in his own blood. He was on his back. We transferred him the same way, disrobed him, hosed him down, saw no entry or exit wounds on the anterior, and, naturally, flipped him to examine the posterior wounds. What do you think I was expecting? I saw the news. I heard the gunshot and saw the people running and the victim fall. I had heard the scuttlebutt that there may have been a conspiracy, that one of the regional potentates may have had a concealed weapon. But I would have appreciated knowing that the man would look like a cocktail wiener with a sword poking through him. I understand. Do you see the damage this weapon did to significant tissue? Not entirely. Well, unless we find bullets in the brain or somewhere else above the neck, it alone killed him. Water was spraying again. I see no bullet holes, do you? No, ma'am. Peter? No. Kirsten? Nope. Doctor? I said no. But this blade, and I'll be able to tell you for sure when I get in there, appears to have gone through vertebrae, perhaps spinal cord, the membrane, the brain stem, the brain itself, the membrane again, and then come out the top of the skull, all none the worse for wear. That would be my observation too, ma'am. It would? Yes. Your expert opinion. I'm no pathologist, but you know enough about the anatomy to know that I shouldn't be surprised if I have guessed the internal damage fairly accurately. Right. But more important, that this weapon appears as lethal now as it must have before it was thrust? I'm afraid so. You see what I'm driving at? I think so. You think so? One of us unsuspecting pathologists so much as brushes a finger against that blade and we're sliced. I'm sorry. And while the victim may be one of the most respected men in the history of the world, we don't know yet, do we, what might be in his blood? Or what might have been on the hands of the perpetrator, do we? We don't. Do you notice anything unusual about the blade, sir? I don't know. I've never seen one quite like it, if that's what you... Simpler than that, Doctor. The cutting edge is facing out. You're sure there's only one cutting edge? Yes, and do you know how I know? Because I was fortunate enough to catch my finger there when we turned over the body. Look here at the top of his head. As we turned him, my hand went behind the head, and hidden there in the hair was the half-inch protrusion of the blade. As soon as it came in contact with my gloved index finger, I flinched and pulled away. Had I done that on the other edge, I dare say it would have cut my finger off. I see. You see. Do you also see our challenge in removing the weapon? A pause. Actually, if it's as strong and sharp as you say, removal should be fairly simple. You just pull it back out the way it entered and... Doctor, may I remind you that the cutting edge is facing away from the body? I know. Then unless we are precise to a millimeter, the blade could cut its way out vertically. Cardinal rule of forensic pathology, do as little damage to the body as possible so it is easier to determine how much trauma was actually inflicted from without. Madeline, if I could have a word. Please. Privately. Excuse us, she said, obviously looking at her assistants. Footsteps. Madeline, I apologize for any part I played in this dangerous situation, but we have been friends a long time. I sold the Supreme Commander on you because I wanted you to have the honor and the income. I resent being berated in front of your subordinates and... Point well taken. I'll say nice things about you when you're gone, and I do appreciate the assignment. I don't know what the benefits are to a mortician asked to evaluate the most famous victim in history, but I do owe you thanks for that. You're welcome, he said flatly, and David heard him leave. Peter and Kirsten returned. Wow, Peter said. Wow is right, Dr. Eikenberry said. That man? Yes. That doctor who just left? She clarified. Yes. I must tell you, he is a complete idiot. The mortician told the transcriptionist to please disregard everything since the turning of the body and to pick up at that point. She explained how she had irrigated the entire wound area and found just the one entry and one exit wound with weapons still in place. The entry wound is considerably larger than the exit, and nearly all the blood flow came from the neck, though understandably there is evidence of blood exiting through eyes, nose, mouth, and ears as well. That the entry wound is clearly larger, while the blade itself is not that much wider there, indicates that the weapon was dug and twisted aggressively. The skull would have held the top of the weapon in place, but the bottom appears to have been flexible enough to inflict severe trauma. David looked at Mac and exhaled. Rayford's in the clear. I mean, he might get busted for shooting at Carpathia, but he couldn't have killed him. Mac shook his head. Sounds to me like Carpathia was murdered by one of his own people. It sure does, David said. There was talk of one of the potentates with something in his coat. But I want to see the video discs. Buck awoke late morning, stiff and sore. The sun blinded, but Chaim remained asleep. Buck took a closer look at Chaim's ratty blanket. The inside was blood-encrusted, and he wondered how the old man could stand it. He also worried that some of the blood might be Chaim's own. Buck carefully tugged at the blanket to see if any blood stained Chaim's pajamas, but Chaim held tight and turned over, exposing his back. No wounds or stains that Buck could see. "You awake?" the old man mumbled, still facing away from Buck. "Yes, we have to talk." "Later." "Now." "Why don't you go find me some clothes? I need to get home, and I can't go like this." "You don't think the GC is waiting for you there?" Chaim rolled over to face Buck, squinting against the sunlight. "And why would they be? Where's my phone? I want to call the house, talk to Yakov." "Don't."
"Why not?"
"Don't, Chaim. I know the truth. I know what happened." "You saw nothing. No one saw anything." "You can't admit to me what I know already? What kind of a friend are you?" Chaim got up and relieved himself, then returned to sit wearily on the bed. His white hair pointed everywhere.
"You should be happy," he said.
"Happy? Of course. What do you care how the deed was done so long as it was done? I care because you did it. You don't know that. And what if I did? You'll die for it, that's what. You think I want that? Chaim cocked his head and shrugged. You're a better friend than I, Cameron. I'm beginning to think so. Chaim chuckled. I can't cheer you, eh? Tell me how you did it, Chaim. The less you know, the less you have to answer for. Oh, don't be naive. You've been around too long for that. I have to answer for everything. I have to be grateful for facial lacerations, because if I hadn't suffered them, I would have had to change my appearance anyway. Telling me you murdered Carpathia won't add much to my plate. They have enough on me, manufactured or otherwise, to put me away on sight, so tell me. I'm telling no one. This is mine alone. But you know you can't go home. I can tell my people where I am, that I am all right. You must come to the States with me. I can't leave my country, my staff. Chaim, listen to me. Your staff is dead. They were tortured and massacred last night by the GC, probably trying to get to you. Chaim looked up slowly, his hair casting wild shadows on the far wall. Don't talk crazy, he said warily. That is not amusing. I wouldn't joke about that, Chaim. Yakov was killed by a blow to the chin that broke his neck. A guard hit him with the butt end of an Uzi when he tried to rush to you. Chaim put a hand over his mouth and sucked in a noisy breath. Don't, he said, his words muffled. Don't do this to me. I didn't do it, Chaim. You did it. He's dead? You know for certain he's dead? I checked his pulse myself. What have I done? Hannah Laura and her mother and Stefan are gone, too. Chaim stood and moved toward the door as if wanting to leave, but knowing he had nowhere to go. No, he wailed. Why? Someone had to know, Chaim. Someone had to have seen you. Surely you didn't expect to get away with it. Chaim's knees gave way, and he hit the floor hard, a high-pitched cry in his throat. You checked the pulses at my home, too? Buck nodded. That was not smart. You could have been killed, too. And my death would have been your fault, too, Chaim. Look what's happened. Chaim turned and leaned over the bed, still kneeling. He buried his face in his hands. I was willing to die, he managed. I didn't care about myself. The sword was perfect and fit into the tubing of my chair just so. No one knew, not even Yakov. Oh, Yakov, Yakov, what have I done to you? Cameron, you must kill me. You must avenge those deaths. He stood quickly and opened the window. If I lose my nerve, you must push me. Please, I cannot bear this. Shut the window, Chaim. I'm not going to kill you, and I won't let you kill yourself. I'll not turn myself into those swine. I wouldn't give them the satisfaction. Oh, I will kill myself, Cameron. You know I will. You'll have to try without me present. I love you too much, Chaim. I will die before you do to keep you from going to hell. Hell? If God would send me to hell for murdering such a monster, I will go happily. But he should send me to hell for what I did to my people. Oh, Cameron! He collapsed onto the bed, rolling into a fetal position and groaning as if about to burst. Suddenly he sat up, seeming eager to relive the deed. I was going to leap from my chair at just the right moment, weapon in hand. He is so much taller, I had been practicing my jumping. I was going to leap as high as I could and, with both hands on the handle, drive the blade down through the top of his head. The whole world would see and know. There were all those shenanigans on the stage, people standing, sitting, moving, laughing. I joined in, measuring the distance, seeing where I could maneuver the chair. When he came to greet me and lift my hand, I came close to reaching across my body to lift out the sword and plunge it into his heart, but my angle was wrong. I would not have had the leverage to get the blade out, let alone to thrust it where I needed to. I was rolling toward him, finally, as he moved my way. My plan was to turn quickly at the last minute and trip him. Then I would leap from the chair and kill him. But just as he got near me, the gun went off. At first I thought I had been detected and that his security guards had shot me. He lurched my way away from the sound of the gun and the shattering lectern. I could see that he was about to tumble into my lap, so I quickly withdrew the blade. I didn't have time even to orient it in my hands. I pointed it straight up and held steady as he fell back onto it. I held firm and tried to scrape the brain from his evil head. He jerked, and I let go. He rolled to my feet. It was chaos. People came running. I steered away, and for an instant I thought I had gotten away with it. The timing, the shot, I could tell it came from the crowd, and as I ran away I wondered if it might be mistaken for a two-person crime. I had plotted an unlikely escape just on a lark, and here I am. Who would have believed it? Buck sat shaking his head. Chaim rolled back over, moaning. "You're right," he whispered. "It's all on me. I did this to them." "Oh, no, no, no." Buck heard voices below the window. Three vagrants sat sharing a bottle. "Which of you would like a 50-nick note?" he called down. Two waved him off, but a young drunk stood quickly.
"What I gotta do?"
"Buy me some clothes and shoes with this 20, and when you bring 'em back, keep the change and get another 50. The other two laughed and tried to sing. The young drunk squinted and let his head fall back.
"How do you know I won't run off with your 20?
"My risk," Buck said. "Your loss. You want 20 or 50?
"Gimme,"
the man said, reaching. Buck let the bill flutter down, which brought the other two to their feet to compete for it. The younger shoved them away and got it easily. Buck felt better about his chances when the man turned back to him and said,
"What size?"
"No deal," Abdullah said on the phone.
"What's the problem?"
David said.
"The guy had the fear of God in him. Wouldn't let those discs out of his sight. I didn't even get the machine out of my bag. He said he'd stand there and watch while I logged them in, if I had to.
I just hope they're not bringing them here to destroy them. They're the only hope of exonerating Rayford."
"Exonerating? What's that mean?"
"Getting him off the hook."
"No, sir," Abdullah said. "He didn't even have to pull the trigger to be guilty. He drew down on Carpathia. What more do they need? He needs to stay as far away from here as he can."
Chapter 9. 7 hours later. David hated getting so little time with Annie, but he knew their exile was fast approaching. Then, if they could pull it off, they would be together as much as they wanted, and probably a long, long way from New Babylon.
What an incredibly beautiful city New Babylon would have been under other circumstances. Carpathia had employed the best architects and landscapers and designers and decorators, and except for the absence of any God-honoring works of art, the place looked magnificent, particularly at night. Great colored spotlights accented the massive, crystalline buildings. Only since the recent decimation of another huge percentage of the population and the resulting personnel shortages had the place begun to evidence the lack. It took longer for refuse removal or for lights to be repaired, yet still the skyline was stunning, a man-made marvel. As dusk crept over the horizon, David sat listening to Fortunato, Hickman, and Moon through the bug in Carpathia's office. He couldn't tell whether Leon was actually in Nikolai's chair, but it sure sounded like it. They were watching the videos that had been brought back from the gala. David sat with his head in his hands, using earphones to be sure to catch every detail. He wished he could see the videos, but that was not his call. They played and replayed and replayed clips that included the gunshot. "See," Moon said. "He's right down there, stage right, about 3 or 4 deep. There. See? Pause."
"I see it, Walter," Leon said. "Good thing we've got fingerprints. I would not have been able to tell who that was in 1,000,000 years.
"Good get-up," Hickman said. "The gray hair sticking out of the turban. Nice touch. Robes. I would have thought he was an Arab."
"Some kind of raghead, anyway." They all chuckled.
"Rayford Steele," Leon said softly. "Who'd have believed that? Wouldn't murder be against his religion?" Laughter, silence. Then,
"I don't know." It was Hickman. "Maybe he convinces himself it's a holy war. Then I guess everything goes."
"Fact is," Moon said, "he missed."
"You look close," Hickman said, "and he had a better shot earlier. He fires then, he's our guy, but I don't think he even meant to shoot when he did."
"What are you talking about?"
"Look, slow motion, well, back it up a second first. Look, right there, somebody bumps him, a little person, a woman? Can you zoom?"
"I don't know how to run these crazy machines," Leon said. "We ought to get Hasid in here. You want me to call him?"
"Maybe. Just a minute. Here."
"Okay. Slow and zoomed.
What do you see?"
"There," Hickman said again. "She trips, loses her balance or something."
"Ha! Who's that look like?
Wally, who's that remind you of?"
"Nah. No? Come on. Who am I thinking of?"
"I know who you're thinking of, but we've got her eyeballed in North America. Probably trying to get to her sister's funeral. She doesn't know it was 1 month ago."
They chuckled again, and David picked up the phone.
"Rayford," he said. "Maybe Hattie's not on her way to the safe house yet. GC's tracked her out west, trying to make her sister's funeral."
"That's a relief. Maybe we're okay for a while."
"Don't get overconfident. I uploaded a whole bunch of stuff to Chloe's computer so you can see your new digs if you need 'em."
"Where are you?"
"Well, I was about to put down at Paul Walkie when I heard from Leah. I've been having trouble reaching T to see if he could go get her in Kankakee, southeast of here. She never got him either, so I'm on my way to get her. We'll come back here and use Buck's car to see if we can get to the safe house."
"Call Zion first. Last time I talked to him, he said he thought he heard car noises."
"That's not good."
"Tell me about it," David said.
"Hey, Leah might need a new alias."
"Yeah? Why?"
"She's been asking around about Hattie using that Clendenin name. They might try to follow her to Hattie."
"They're already on to Hattie. They don't need Leah."
"Whatever you say, Rayford, just a thought."
"I appreciate it."
"You'd better be careful. They're gonna try to pin this on you."
David told him of the autopsy and evidence investigation.
"So I missed, just like you thought?"
"Looks pretty sure at this point." Then how can they pin it on me? What, they're obligated to the truth? If you didn't do it, someone on the platform did.
My money's on one of the three insurgent kings, Rayford said. Probably Litwala.
Even if you're right, you're a less embarrassing assassin than someone behind Nikolai. I'll bet you're the scapegoat.
Buck had sat with the morose Chaim Rosenzweig the whole day. The old man had alternately slept and wept, threatening suicide. Buck wanted to go out and find them something to eat, but he didn't dare leave Chaim. The drunk came back to toss a bundle of used clothes up to the window, but he wasn't interested in more money to find food. Once he had his 50, he was gone. Buck called the desk. Anybody down there that could bring us some food for a fee?
What, you think we got room service?
Just tell me if you know anybody who wants to make a few nicks.
Yeah, okay. When the concierge gets off his break, I'll send him up. You'll recognize him by his tuxedo.
Amazingly, 10 minutes later, someone knocked tentatively. Buck wished he had a gun.
Who is it?
I'll get you food, a man said.
How much?
10.
Deal.
Buck sent him out for local fare. It was all he could do to get Chaim to eat a few bites. Presently, David called.
Is it true? He asked.
About Chaim?
Buck was stunned.
What about him?
That he's dead, burned up at his home, along with his whole staff?
You know that's not true, David. Hasn't anyone told you I'm with him?
I'm just telling you what's on television.
So that's how they're going to spin it? Hero statesman dies in a fire? That keeps him out of the conspiracy?
They're convinced one of the three insurgents did it, David said. But that would be bad for morale.
What's Chaim's theory? He was right there.
We need to talk about this later, David. I need to get him out of here.
How?
I finally got hold of T. He's bringing the Super J. I directed him to a blocked-off road. We have to be there when he puts down so he can be in the air again before anyone's the wiser. We'll have to stop in Greece for fuel, though. Wouldn't want to risk it over here.
Zion was alarmed. Chloe was proposing madness.
Can I trust you with Kenny, she said, that you won't fall asleep?
I would give my life for that child, you know that. But you must not go. This is foolishness.
Zion, I can't sit here doing nothing. I have informed everyone in the co-op generally what's going on, but there's little I can do until the buying-selling restrictions are sanctioned. Don't keep me from doing something worthwhile.
I am not your superior, Chloe. I could not deprive you of anything. I'm just urging you to think this through. Why must you go, and why must it be now? Cameron's car is at the airport. If you take the Suburban, you leave me with no vehicle.
You have nowhere to go, Zion. You can't outrun the GC anyway. Your best bet is to stay right here, listen for them, turn the power off if you hear them, and become invisible.
Zion threw up his arms.
I cannot dissuade you, so do what you are going to do, but don't be long.
Thank you, and promise me you will do anything but let Kenny fall into GC hands.
I would die first.
I want him to die first.
That I will not do.
You would let them take him?
Over my body.
But don't you see, Zion, that's how it will be. You'll be a martyr, but you will still have lost Kenny to the enemy.
You're right. You'd better stay here.
Nice try.
This is not a smart thing to do in broad daylight.
I'll be careful.
Too late. You're already being reckless.
Goodbye, Zion.
What do you make of this? Hickman was saying as David listened in.
Ramblings, Leon said. Hallucinations, gibberish, not uncommon in such a situation. But first he said that about thinking he had done all you asked. What was that about?
Nikolai was not addressing me. I have never, would never, could never ask him to do anything. Anyway, if he was talking to me, it would indicate that he thought I had attacked him.
But then what is his obsession with the, what does he call it?
The veil or the, what?
Listen to what he says.
David pressed both earphones close and listened carefully. After Carpathia's first lament, which echoed through the sound system, the PA system appeared to have failed, but his next words were picked up through the video disc machine mic.
The veil, Carpathia rasped. Was it rent in twain from the top to the bottom?
Carpathia struggled to make himself understood.
Father, he managed. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do.
David shuddered. The exchange reminded him of something he and Mac had heard from the morgue. He called Mac.
What was it Dr. Eikenberry said about reports of Nikolai's last words?
Just that it would have been impossible.
That's what I thought. Once she got in there and saw the damage, she said he wouldn't have been able to speak, right?
Exactly. David re-cued the recording and found it.
Well, Dr. Eikenberry said, this gives the lie to the last words business, doesn't it?
It sure does, Peter said, unless he could speak supernaturally.
He and the doctor and Kirsten laughed. This man couldn't have said a word, Dr. Eikenberry concluded. Maybe they want to invent something for posterity, but no one had better ask me if it was possible.
A few minutes after 9 in the morning, Central Standard Time, Rayford put the Gulfstream down in Kankakee. He had told Leah to watch for a smallish jet and to be ready to board quickly. But as he taxied by the terminal, he saw her sleeping in a chair by the window. He left the jet whining on the tarmac, knowing how conspicuous that would look to ground control, and sprinted into the terminal.
Donna, he said as he approached. Donna Clendenin.
She jumped and squinted at him.
Do I know you? She said, clearly terrified.
Marv Berry, he said, grabbing her bag. We've got to go.
Hi, Marv, she whispered. You've got to tell a girl when you get a makeover.
Rayford heard some kind of warning through the PA system, and a couple of orange-vested officials started his way. He ignored them and was airborne quickly, certain that Kankakee had no GC pursuit craft and little interest in a small jet flyer who had boorishly violated their protocols. He told Leah, "All I get out of Pulwalkie is a tower guy who says T is not there and won't be back until tomorrow, and that he's not at liberty to say where he went."
I got the same. What do you make of it?
I don't know. Wish there was someone in his church I could ask, but T and I have never needed to communicate through third parties. He's usually reachable by cell. He's always wanted to be in on the action, and I need someone to go and ferry Buck and Chaim over here. I'm tempted to call Albie and see if he can find someone.
Now there's a name I haven't heard, Leah said.
Albie? Long story. Good guy.
So tell me.
Not until you and I clear up a few things.
Until you do, you mean, she said.
Rayford told her what had happened to him in Israel on the flight to Greece and in Greece. I know that sounds a little too convenient, he said, and I wouldn't blame you if you thought I just made it up to...
Made it up, she said, obviously emotional. If you made that up, you'd burn in hell.
So, will you be the first to forgive me?
Of course, and I need to apologize too.
You've done nothing close to what I did, Rayford said. Forget it.
Don't brush me off, Rayford. I feel awful about how I've responded to you.
Fair enough. We're even.
Don't be flippant.
I'm not. You can imagine how I feel about...
I'm not saying I was as terrible as you, she said wryly.
David responded to an announcement that all GC management personnel from director level and above were to report immediately to the small theater in the education wing. What now? As dozens crowded into the room, Fortunato stood at the lectern like a professor. "Quickly now, quickly, please, find your seats. I've been informed that more than 1 million people are in New Babylon already, with probably at least 2 million more to come. Our social services are being taxed to their limits, and these people have no outlet for their grief. I want to know if there is any reason we cannot put the body of the potentate in position even this evening and begin the procession past the bier. We're estimating that not half the mourners will stay for the burial, which may have to be postponed as well. Do we have adequate lighting?" Someone shouted, "Yes." "And concessions? Stations with water, food, medical services?" "Could be in place within an hour," someone said. "Good. The bier itself and its pedestal?" "Pedestal is finished and waiting." "Bier is finished, per specifications." "Really?" Fortunato said. "I was told there was some question whether it could be vacuum sealed." "Solved with a little help. Once the body is, placed inside, the air can be quickly removed and the hole secured. The stopper is a hard rubber compound that will be screwed into the plexiglass." "Thank you, we can skip the details." "The entire container is transparent?" "Yes, sir. And on the pedestal it will sit nearly 15 feet off the ground." "Yet the mourners will have access?" "Via stairs leading up one side and down the other. They will, of course, be unable to touch the glass, as they will be separated from it by approximately 5 feet with velvet ropes and, armed security." "Thank you," Fortunato said. "Now, there are certain details I would like us all to hear, except those of you who need to supervise construction of the restoring stations. You may be excused now, and let's shoot for an 8 p.m. start time. Let's get the word out to the people so they can begin assembling. Yes, Mr. Blood." Yi had been waving and now stood. "I'm afraid my statue will not be ready until dawn, as originally planned. We're making progress, and I believe it will be stunning, but even the initial goal was nearly impossible." "No problem. You may go now, too, and we'll all look forward to your handiwork." As Guy rushed from the room, Leon called upon Dr. Eikenberry to come to the microphone. "It has been her difficult duty to prepare for burial the body of our beloved leader. As she is a loyal citizen of the global community and was a great admirer of the potentate, you can imagine what an emotional task this was. I have asked her to report on her findings and summarize the challenges she faced to allow the mourners to have one last encounter with His Excellency in as dignified and memorable a manner as possible under the circumstances." Dr. Eikenberry had lost the severe look David had seen when he first met her. Her white coat was gone, and she seemed to have applied fresh makeup and had her hairdo softened. He wondered when she had had time for that. "Thank you, Supreme Commander," she began. "This has indeed been a most difficult and emotional day for me and my assistants, Peter Berger and Kirsten Skolten. We treated the body of Nikolai Carpathia with utmost reverence and respect. As expected, the cause of death was severe brain trauma caused by a single bullet from a saber handgun. The projectile entered the potentate's body just below the nape of his neck in the back and exited through the top of the cranium, through the top of his head. The particularly devastating power of this type of projectile destroyed 2 vertebrae, severed the spinal cord, obliterated the brain stem and posterior of the brain, and left residual damage to the carotid artery and much of the soft tissue in the throat. Because of the spinning bullet, the back of the neck and head were laid open, causing the greatest challenge for repair and reconstruction. Without getting into the details, the gaping wound has been stapled and stitched,
camouflaged with wax and putty and coloring and a minimum of artificial hair. If the result contributes to an appropriate farewell to the greatest leader the world has ever known, I am grateful and consider it a privilege to have served the global community this way. Amid tears and sustained applause, Dr. Eikenberry began to leave, then returned to the podium with an index finger raised. "If I may add one thing," she said. "There is recorded evidence that His Excellency's last words were an expression of forgiveness to the perpetrator of this heinous crime. Forgiveness has long been ascribed to the divine, and as a medical professional, I must tell you why I concur with this assessment. Besides the sentiment of those last words, I can tell you that there is no human explanation for the potentate's ability to speak at all, given the physical damage. Truly, this was a righteous man. Truly, this was the Son of God." At Paul Walkie, Rayford tried in person to get more information out of the tower fill-in. "I'm sorry, sir," the man said, "but not only am I not at liberty to tell you, I couldn't if I wanted to. He didn't tell me where he was going, but only when he expected to return." "Do you know who I am?" "No, sir." "You haven't seen me around here, don't know I'm a friend of T's?" The man squinted at Rayford, and Leah cleared her throat. He may not recognize you." Rayford couldn't believe his own stupidity. "Listen, son, I have permission to take an associate's vehicle, but he neglected to leave the keys with me. I need to know you won't feel obligated to phone any authorities if I were to hotwire the car." The man's look was not as reassuring as his words. "I won't even be looking in your direction." "He doesn't trust you," Leah said as they strode to the Land Rover. "Why should he? I wouldn't either. See? Even forgiven sin has its consequences." "Do we have to spiritualize everything?" Leah said, but Rayford could tell she was bemused. Once they were on the road, she said, "We're not going straight to the safe house in broad daylight, are we?" "Of course not. We have a stop first." He drove to Des Plaines and the one-pump gas station run by Zeke and Zeke Jr. Zeke emerged quickly, but hesitated when he saw Rayford. He looked past him to Leah. "I recognize the vehicle," he said, "but not the occupants." "It's me, Zeke, and this is Leah." "That wasn't Z's handiwork, was it?"
"Hers was."
"Not bad. Yours either. Need auto work?"
"Yep."
Zeke ignored the pump and opened the ancient garage door. Rayford pulled in, and he and Leah got out so Zeke could raise the car on the rack. Then the three of them took a hidden staircase to the basement, where Zeke Jr. looked up expectantly. "Sup," he said.
"You know me?"
Rayford said.
"Not till you spoke, but I would have got it."
"What do you need?"
"New ID for her."
Zeke Jr. stood, rolls of fat jiggling under his black vest and shirt.
"Jerry Seaver," he said.
"Excuse me?
How's Jerry Seaver sound?"
"How does she look?" Leah said. Zeke grabbed a file.
"Like this."
"You're a genius," she said. The blonde was roughly her age, height, and weight. "I don't know how you do it."
"Lots more to choose from these days," he said shyly.
He directed her to a sink and gave her the chemicals necessary to make her a blonde. She and Rayford drove off 2 hours later with foodstuffs, a full tank, and Leah in a scarf over wet, freshly bleached hair. Her dental appliance had been changed, as had the color of her contacts. In her purse was a wallet with documents to match.
"I'm going to take the northern route," Rayford said. "That'll give us a good look at any other traffic."
"Unless they're hidden."
"Not too many places to do that," he said.
Shall we wait till dark, too?
You're asking me?
We both live or die by the decision, he said.
That helps.
He phoned the safe house. Zion answered.
She's where? Tell me she's not. Oh, Zion, what about the radiation? The...
Zion told him what David had told them about the radiation. Rayford pulled over and covered the mouthpiece.
We're waiting till dark, he said, popping a U-turn.
Where to till then?
Chicago, and watch our backs in case you were right about Tower Boy.
Rayford phoned Chloe and eschewed any pleasantries.
Where are you? He said. Palis area, she said. I'm guessing where the tri-state used to intersect Harlem.
95th Street?
Uh-huh.
What now? You going the rest of the way on foot?
I may have to.
That'll take hours.
What else have I got to do, Dad?
At least wait for us. You're more likely to give us away than Hattie is. We've got both vehicles out in the daytime. On foot, you'll stick out like a sore thumb. We're as exposed as we've ever been.
Just tell her what to do, Rayford, Leah said. You're back in charge, remember?
What? Chloe said. Rayford covered the phone.
She's a married adult, Leah, not my little girl anymore. But she's subordinate to you in the Trib Force. Do what you have to do.
Chloe?
Yes?
Stay put until we can find you. We're not doing this thing until after dark.
Chapter 10. Buck was having a crisis of conscience. It would have been one thing to be harboring Carpathia's assassin had it been Rayford or another misguided believer for whom the deed could have at least been rationalized as an act of war. But Chaim? He professed no faith, no acrimony toward Carpathia from a spiritual standpoint. The man had committed first-degree murder, and regardless of what Buck thought about the victim, it was a crime.
So, what are you going to do?
Chaim pressed him as they languished at the Night Visitors Hotel in Jerusalem.
Turn me in? Abandon me? Your conscience can't take what I did to your worst enemy. I cannot abide what I have done to my dearest friends. They died for me.
Greater love hath no man.
You've quoted that before, Cameron.
And I know where you want to go with it, but they had no choice. Perhaps they would have died for me voluntarily, but this was my doing. I forced their deaths.
Would you have done the same for them? Would you have died for them?
I'd like to think I would. I should now.
Stop talking like that.
You think I am not sincere? The only things standing in the way are you and my cowardice.
Cowardice?
You planned the assassination for months, virtually told me you were going to do it by showing me your blade making. I don't know where my head was. And you pulled it off according to plan. Right or wrong, it was hardly evidence of cowardice.
Ah!
Chaim waved him off.
I am a fool and a coward, and the blood of my people is on my hands.
Buck paced. Because the GC are already announcing that you're dead, they can kill you without explanation.
Let them. I deserve it. I'm a murderer.
Buck turned the chair backward and straddled it.
What happens when your victim comes back to life?
Then what is your crime?
Attempted murder?
What if there's no evidence of the wound you inflicted?
You're talking crazy now, Cameron.
It's going to happen, Chaim.
I know you say that, and Zion says that. But come now, the man was in my lap when I thrust the blade into his brain. For all practical purposes, he was dead before he hit the floor. He could not have survived it. You can't really believe he is coming back to life.
But what if he does?
Chaim waved him off again.
don't do that. You're an intellectual, a lifelong student and teacher and scientist. Humor the debate. What if Carpathia comes back to life? Chaim rolled on the bed and turned his back to Buck.
Then I guess you'll all be right, I'll be wrong. You'll win.
You're not pretending that it has actually happened.
You said yourself I have a thinking man's brain. I find it impossible to consider impossibilities.
That's why we've never gotten through to you. All our arguing and pleading.
You've gotten through more than you know, Cameron. I have come from atheism to agnosticism and finally to belief in God.
You believe?
In God, yes, I told you that. Too many things have happened that can be explained no other way.
Then why not Carpathia's resurrection?
You can't tell me that you yourself actually believe this, Chaim said.
Oh, yes, I can, and I do. You forget I was there when Eli and Moshe came back to life after 3 days in the hot sun.
You believe what you want to believe.
Buck looked at his watch. I wish it would get dark. I want out of here.
You should leave me, young friend. Distance yourself from me. Pretend you never met me.
Buck shook his head, though Chaim was still turned away from him.
Can't do that, he said. We go back way too far. I was merely the subject of an article. We didn't have to become friends.
But we did. And now I love you and can't let you go. You think you have nothing else to live for.
True enough.
But you do. You do. You know what I fear for you, Chaim.
You're afraid I will die in unbelief and go to hell.
There's something more frightening. What if you wait too long to change your mind and God hardens your heart?
Meaning? Chaim rolled over to face him.
Meaning that you finally decide it's true and want to give yourself to Christ, but you had already pushed God past where he would allow you to come back.
Explain to me how that fits with your view of a loving God who is not willing that any should perish.
I don't understand it myself, Chaim. I'm new at this, but Dr. Ben-Judah teaches that the Bible warns about just that during the end times. Be careful that you don't go too far, that you ignore too many warnings and signs.
God would do that?
I believe so.
To me?
Why not? Chaim let his head rest on the mattress, then covered his face with his arms.
Ready to engage in the debate? Buck pressed.
I'm tired, Cameron.
You slept well.
I slept. Not well. How could I? I can't imagine. But this is too important for you to brush aside.
You have pleaded with me before. I have heard every argument from you and from Zion. I could make your case for you.
Then think about what may happen to you. Say I get cold feet and abandon you. Even if you are a coward and unable to take your own life, someone is going to take it for you. Then what?
I like to believe death is the end.
It's not, Buck said.
Listen to the new believer, full of knowledge. You can't know.
Chaim, if all this stuff that has amazed you and made you believe God is real, why shouldn't heaven and hell be real? If there's a God, why would he want you to die and disappear into nothingness? It makes no sense.
You're repeating yourself.
You're holding out, Chaim. You're like the faint-hearted who want one more sign. I just don't want you to wait past the point of no return.
Ah!
Just think about it, will you? What it would mean if the prophecy were fulfilled. Nikolai was the Antichrist, and he resurrected from the dead.
I don't want to think about it. I want to die.
You wouldn't if you believed what I believe.
That I agree with.
You do?
Of course. Who would want to go to hell?
You don't have to, Chaim. God has...
I know. All right, I know. Stop talking.
I will, but just consider, please, how you would feel if Nikolai...
For the love of...
I'll shut up now, Chaim. But...
Buck's phone rang.
Maybe there is a God, Chaim said. The patron saint of phones has saved me.
This is Buck.
Buck, is it really you?
Hattie.
Buck stood so quickly his chair bounced away.
Where are you?
Colorado, she said. You're on a secure phone? One thing I absconded with, one of those from your friend on the inside.
I'm listening.
The GC think I'm dumber than I am. They released me from prison, gave me money, and then followed me here. I know they were disappointed I didn't go to Israel, but I wanted to see if any of my family was left.
And? Her voice caught.
No, not for a while. But you know where they hope I'll go now.
Exactly where I hope you won't go.
Buck, I have nowhere else to turn.
He ran a hand through his hair.
I'd love to help you, Hattie, but
I understand. I had my chance.
That's not it. It's all right, Buck. You owe me nothing.
It has nothing to do with owing you anything, Hattie. I'm in the middle of a situation myself, and until you can shake the GC, I can't advise that you head back to the safe house. Everybody's welfare is at stake.
I know, she said, and he heard the terror in her voice.
Would you please tell everyone that I never told anyone where they were?
Hattie,
you as much as put Bo and Ernie on our doorstep.
They couldn't have found their way back there. Anyway, they're both dead, and if they had told anyone, you'd have been raided by now.
What will you do, Hattie?
I don't know, she said wearily. Maybe I'll just run these goons on a wild goose chase until they get tired of me. Heaven knows they gave me enough money.
They're not going to let you out of their sight.